Blog Talk Radio.
Here, One World Talk Show with your host, Greg L. Greer. That'll be me. Today, we're talking to a gentleman who, I tell you, this gentleman, I've known about him for some time, but I really had the pleasure within the last 2 to 3 years of really kind of taking a very close look at him and really seeing what he was made of. And the substance is there, I can guarantee you that. My guest, and you know, I guess we're going to introduce you. I know you're on the line. We're going to introduce you momentarily, but I just want to say some positive things about you, okay? Would that be all right for you?
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So I don't know whether to call you Attorney Wimbiz, Judge. Well, I mean, how do I address you? I want to address you perfectly. How do I do that?
My friends call me Dexter. So I would call
it
an honor for you to call me Dexter. That's it.
Amen.
That's
amen.
That's what my mama named me. So.
Oh man! Hey, listen. Welcome to the show. I really, really, I've been looking forward to this one since we announced it about a week ago, and you were most humbly accepted. And I'm glad to have you. So, without further delay, just let me introduce a little bit about the background. And before I even get into that, if you're listening on a national level and you want to call in and you have any questions for our honorary guest, Dexter Wimbish, right? Pronouncing that right,
yeah.
Right?
That's correct.
It's going to be area code 213-943-3684. Again, if you want to call in on a national level, 213-943-3684. Your background. For decades, attorney Dexter Wimbish has been a fixture permanently between the legal and civil rights communities as a former national general counsel and director of chapters and affiliates for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We know it, most know it as the SCLC, an organization and very well closely associated with this founder, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And Dexter was the head honcho when it came to chapters and legalities, and I mean just everything. I mean he was a nucleus and a source of that organization for a while. So Dexter's been a fighter for the community, working on multiple causes and widely recognized, as a matter of fact. He's a member in good standing with the Georgia Bar Association, which is a great thing because I tell you what, Georgia Red needs to, we need Georgia Blue, okay? So we're gonna talk a little bit about that too in the 30 minutes that we got. So you know what, I appreciate you coming on the show, Dexter, and I still want to say the Honorable Dexter Wimbish, but welcome to the show. Welcome to One World Talks.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, and just so you know, One World Talks brings the best information and guests such as yourself with faith, politics, and news all done from an inspirational perspective. We got 67,000 followers and And I'll tell you what, you can find us on Digital Air America Networks, The Owl Radio, Spreaker.com, and Blog Talk for right now. And this show and the transcript will go out around the country and three other countries. So I appreciate having you. Okay, so, and also, a little bit of cleaning here, a little bit of housework to do. Our show is sponsored by Chicago's Blueprint Bridge Media, a PR one-stop for all your advertising needs. So now that we got that out the way, thank you again for coming on. And I want to just give you the floor for a little bit, a few minutes, to just kind of talk a little bit about, you know, who you are and, you know, the unique things that I know about you. But I want it from your own words right out of the horse's mouth.
Well, thanks for having me. First of all, thanks for having me on, Greg. I'm just a good old country boy from a little small town called Greensboro, Georgia, about 60 miles east of Atlanta. I'm a minister. I'm an attorney, as you mentioned before. I happen to be the first African-American municipal court judge in my hometown of Greensboro, Georgia, since for the past 4 years. Married, got two kids, wonderful wife. Got involved in civil rights right out of law school, actually, about 2 years out of law school. I was traveling the state, working on criminal justice issues, providing service across Georgia's 162 counties, and had an opportunity to get involved with Reverend C.T. Vivian. He at the time was the board chair of an organization called the Center for Democratic Renewal, which was born out of the Klan killings back in North Carolina back in the late 80s. And I was brought on to travel the country documenting the occurrences of church burnings at black churches across the country. And so I spent about 3 or 4 years doing that, documenting more than 225 African-American churches that were being targeted by arson. Out of that came a policy, the National Church Arson Task Force and National Church Arson legislation that made a penalty to attack houses of worship. That's how I got involved [S2] Wow. [S1] In the civil rights movement. That was back in 1996. It was my first foray into civil and human rights. I spent about 6 years there, went up to North Carolina and ran a regional project that looked at money and politics and the intersection of race and how money plays a critical role in identifying as well as electing officials. And did that for a couple of years and actually came back and did another stint with the Center for Democratic Renewal, left there and found myself at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in roughly late 2003, 2004. At the time, Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth was the national president. Reverend Fred Taylor was the field director. And I actually started as a volunteer at SCLC and spent about a year volunteering at SCLC. My volunteer opportunity came to an end. I got ready to go back to practicing law. Then they asked me to stay on. And at that point, I began as the staff counsel, which lasted about a week, and the board promoted me to general counsel shortly thereafter. Spent there for some quiet time. Like you said, I was the director of chapters and affiliates. Had the opportunity to meet some wonderful people who just travel the country. And so that's who I am. I wrote a book a couple of years ago. I had a bout with colon cancer, stage 4 colon cancer. Wrote a book about the trials and challenges of overcoming that. So I guess my life has been pretty full to this point.
Oh, my goodness. You really hit on a lot of areas, Dexter, and, you know, a lot of familiar territory with me. I'm a minister, you know, the SCLC connection, obviously, which, you know, for full disclosure, I was also a member of the SCLC, and I came right around the time when there was a transition between Reverend Creasy and Dr. C.T. Vivian, who took over as an interim. We're talking about 2009, 2010. So I think you preceded me probably about 4 or 5 years there. I, I'm also have also been on the criminal justice stand front with a lot of national causes. So there is a definite kindred spirit, you know. But and with that being said, I just back to you. You know, how, and this is a very interesting time in our country for civil rights, for social justice, and for law. I mean, all of, everything that this really is your career DNA is really, I mean, you can take it in any area. And I'd like to know, what do you think about that? What is your thoughts about the synergy of everything that's going on in the country right now? And, I mean, I really just take your pick, politics, the political situation. I mean, I was looking at the race in Georgia. I was looking at the Georgia governor's race last night, and that's going to be a very polarizing piece for Georgia. And, you know, I mean, what's your thoughts about that?
I am so terrified with the political climate that's present in this country right now. I'm actually a political independent. I don't associate. I guess I'm more of a, I'm not a Republican, and I probably identify more as a Democrat than anything else. But I'm one of those people that believes that when we swear our allegiance to one party wholeheartedly without asking for anything in return, we set ourselves up for failure. And a lot of what we're seeing in Georgia now politically is actually a result of the Democratic Party's refusal to put money into get out the vote campaigns and voter education in the last 10, 15 years, because people think that Georgia's always been a red state. It's just not the case. And, you know, for a half century, Georgia was a blue state. And so they talk about turning Georgia blue. Georgia's always been blue. The problem is that, in my opinion, we've lost touch with our base. Our platforms are not far-reaching enough. They're not advancing. You know, we're talking about when you talk about jobs and economics, there's not enough discussion going on about wage equity. It's not that there aren't jobs out there. You know, there are jobs. People just can't work these jobs and be able to take care of their families. And so because Georgia happens to be in the heart of the South, it's a right-to-work state, employment at will, it comes out of the whole, it's tied to the whole slavery industry in the history of slavery. That's why I think wages are depressed. That's why I think you have companies that refuse to come into the modern-day age and provide protection for workers that can come in and they can fire you for any reason that they give, as long as you don't violate the Constitution. And employees have gotten real good at terminating people and not being held accountable for it. When I look at Georgia, the idea of Brian Kemp becoming governor of Georgia is a terrifying thought. I think that the current President Donald Trump, has divided this country. But what he's done is, you know, under the leadership of President Obama, I think we grew to sleep. I think we started to believe that America had become this colorblind society that it simply had not become. And I think what we're seeing now with Donald Trump is simply America trying to right a ship. I think there are people out there who feel the browning of America, who feel their grip on this country's economic systems, governmental systems. They're losing their hold, and they're playing on people's fears. And we're in a time now that we've actually seen before, because it is really similar to the period following the Reconstruction era. You know, for the last 30, 40 years after Dr. King lost his life, 50 years now, you know, we saw tremendous gains by African Americans and other minorities, and now we're seeing, you know, constant attacks on those gains. And one of the main differences is that we just don't have the types of organizations out there that are fighting the good fight. You know, we have those who've been around for years who still continue to fight. We've got Black Lives Matter, but what we don't have is we don't have any unified forces out there. And I think as a community, we've been separated. And I think that's why we're seeing the problems that we have now. You know, whether it's the continued you know, you take black on black crime. You know, it's sad that we as a community can't have a discussion about black on black crime without somebody saying, well, you're blaming the victim. No, I'm not blaming the victim, but we've got to take a real look at the societal problems that create these situations. And that's a lack of jobs, lack of access to education, but also it's a lack of importance and value in our community for not only our young people, some people who are not quite so young. I think the value of African-American life has plummeted in the last half century. And when I speak about African-Americans, because as I approach the age of 50, Greg, I think it's time that we as a community focus on saving ourselves as opposed to waiting on somebody else to save us.
Well, you know, it's funny that, you know, Dexter, that you mentioned the situation with the workplace, and kind of went into right to work. I call it right to fire, really, to be honest with you, but, you know, that's just my take on it. So, you know, there was a study of over 400 federal cases, and it represented workplace racial harassment jurisprudence over a 20-year period. And I wish I didn't research the organization, so I got to go back and put that when I shared the links. But it said that African-American judges rule differently than white judges, even when we take into account their political affiliation and case characteristics. And, you know, at the same time, the judges, this findings and the study indicates that judges of all races are attentive to relevant facts of the cases, right, but interpret them differently. So, you know, thus, while we can't predict how an individual judge might act, the study suggested that African-American judges as a group and white judges as a group perceive racial harassment differently. Do you find that these types of scenarios, and we're talking about workplace racial harassment, there's a flurry of other issues out there, but, you know, how do you feel about the scales of justice? And you know what it said, you know what they look like, right? Unbalanced. What do you think are some of the opportunity areas with going forward within the next 20 years, considering the fact that there is a browning of America and the racial makeup and demographic of our country is changing so much?
Well, we got to start with the premise that justice should be colorblind, but at the same time, understand that practically justice cannot be colorblind. As a judge, I get the opportunity to hear cases and decide cases in the criminal area, particularly. And you can see, even from a prosecutor's standpoint, how they approach certain cases. Certain aspects and opportunities are made available to those who look like them and not those who don't have the same skin color. But a couple years ago after the Ferguson, the Department of Justice put out a very interesting report on ways that we can sort of even the scales. And it talked about looking at alternative sentencing, understanding that America's criminal justice system is broken.
Is that Loretta Lynch or Eric Holder's Justice Department?
That would have been
when you saw this. Okay, okay. I'm sorry for interrupting. Please proceed.
And it talked about alternative sentencing, because what we see in the criminal justice system in particular, the influence of money, the influence of private prisons, the influence of private probation companies. There is this need to keep our jails full. Now, we're seeing some light right now with the opioid crisis, because the opioid crisis has a different skin color, different tint, and that's just the reality of it. When we had the crack epidemic, it was mostly African Americans, and the mantra was lock them up, lock them up, lock them up. And now that we have this a growing opioid crisis, it's interesting that the mantra is they need to be given the tools to get off of drugs, counseling, And that's because the people who make the decisions most times don't look like us. And so as we go forward, the positive thing is if we can mobilize these the different minorities to begin to elect not only at the national level but the local levels. You know, here in Georgia, I'm a municipal court judge. We hear far more cases in municipal court than our state court judges or our superior court judges, and certainly our appellate judges. And so one of the things that we're trying to do in my court is to create a accountability court and diversion program where we can get young people and other into treatment plans. One of the things that I do in my courtroom, I trade diplomas for dismissals. If I got a young kid that comes in and never been in trouble before, and they got a drug possession charge and they don't have a diploma, I say, I'm going to put your case on hold, go get a diploma or a GED or enroll in college, bring it back, and I'll dismiss your charge. It won't be in your record.
Wow.
You give those
That's
kids
beautiful.
A second
wow.
chance. And those are the kinds of things that we have to start looking at, because we got to understand a lot of these kids just don't have a support system. And when they don't have a support system at home, and then they find themselves involved with a criminal justice system, it is almost an obstacle they can't overcome. Now, as it relates to the employment side of it, that I've done employment law probably for the last 20 years or so off and on. And it can be one of the most discouraging areas of law. And one of the reasons being is that as we've evolved over the last 25 years, you don't see the type of overt racism that we used to see. Even though about 15 years ago, I did a study on noose harassment in the workplace. And I went back for about 10 years and looked at the cost of these settlements in corporate America around finding nooses in the workplace, in the workspace of African Americans. And it totaled in the tens of millions of dollars. You know, hatred and racism have a financial cost. And so one of the things we can do is to make companies understand it's actually a better business practice to implement policies that promote inclusion rather than simply just ignore it. Another issue that we have is that we have people who we have issues around colorism. There are a lot of cases where you've got light-skinned blacks and dark-skinned blacks going at each other within the workplace with some really bad consequences, but historically it has not been seen as racism. Now the EEOC.
Can I chime in on that? Because I'm going to tell you what.
Okay.
The many times that I've been in Atlanta, I'm just going to be honest with you. Y'all got it bad out there. I mean, this inferiority complex is so deep rooted. I mean, goodness. Y'all have got it bad. But if we could do this, Dexter, because you hit on some pertinent points too. You know, in the rash of high profile killings of unarmed black males, John Crawford III, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, Tamir Rice, the case which I advocated for and led, Walter Scott, you know, and this is not I want to get this clear for anybody who's going to listen or is listening. This is not a race issue to the point where as we are addressing it, but if we don't talk about the problems and hit them hard where they stand with sincere conversations, then we can't clear the issue. So we're not racist, but we want to be able to talk about how these things exist. So I want to say that white prosecutors appear to be reluctant to vigorously pursue indictments against some of these police officers, and reports, you know, by different organizations and societies. I mean, you've seen them all, and you know, they conclude that almost none of the officers who kill you know, roughly 1,000 people a year on the average of color are ever charged. What do you think about that? What do you think?
I think it's disgusting. I think it is, like I said, a continuation of a corrupt system. I believe that the vast majority of the perpetrators are not these diehard racists, but rather they live within a culture that looks to paint African Americans as criminals. And this position is held not only by white officers, but many officers of color who turn their head to these types of activities. The notion for that a lot of these killings, they evolve out of nonviolent confrontations that are escalated. And you're right. It's like, what do you need to show that these killings are based on race? Because if you remove race from all of these incidents, there's no other rationale for why this person is being treated the way they're being treated. You know, why is it that why are black men and women being targeted in this community? Well, they're being targeted because I think there's a growing fear in this country. And there are people who continue to push this fear down our throats. And so when a police officer responds to a scene and the person they're responding to is black, there is a preconceived notion that they should respond with violence. Whereas if they respond and the person is not of African descent or not a person of color, they approach it in a different manner. What's going on? What do we have here? You know, what's the problem? But when they approach African Americans, is hands in the air, get on the ground, guns are drawn.
This very dismissive, punitive type of thing, when altogether policing is supposed to be a restorative, bringing balance back to the community. Not you me mugging me for a traffic ticket, and then that turns into whatever else is turned into, which are tragic circumstances in a lot of cases. And not a lot of cases. I'm gonna correct myself. In some very notable cases, put it to, but which one more segue, because we got about, and I need about an hour with you. I'm just gonna be honest with you. Let's say this. You know it's me. I gotta hit you. Mm-hmm. I gotta hit you on this in about 1 minute. So, you know, you have been involved in some, and I want to hit you on that SCLC piece. You know, there was a time, a very charged time, to where, as you know, there was a battle to all Riley Trimble of Dayton, and, you know, there were some funds that were being diverted. And, I mean, you know what, let's just get straight to the chase. What do you think about the SCLC, and how do we make it effective Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 90 seconds?
Okay, let me first say, you know, due to some ethical constraints, you know, there's only so much I can say. Historically speaking, there's been another number of civil rights organizations that had issues with internal controls. And when the whole issue came about the mismanagement of funds, I was actually placed in charge of the investigation. In retrospect, when I look back, I think some people think that was a mistake, because when I'm asked to do something, I'm going to do it. And once I start uncovering stones, and you find people that you're a friend, there's some questionable circumstances going on, I have an obligation to the organization to see it to the end. One of my things was, I tried my very best, Greg, to counsel the organization and not to have such a public fight, because the organization is so important. And I think the public fight that was had, being, you know, in court, having having your dirty laundry aired, it put a bad taste in everybody's mouth.
Including myself and a lot of people in the community. But you know what? We need to come back to you on this because it's very important. How do people reach you, Dexter? Please tell us. How would they reach you? And if anybody has any questions, they can reach us through One World Talks. But how would you suggest that they reach you?
The best place to hit me on my cell phone, it's after 20 years, it's public, 770-861-7054, or Facebook. I'm pretty available on Facebook also.
Well, I'd like to tell you, you're a great man of honor, and thank you for coming on. And then we got to get you back on again, okay?
Anytime, Greg.
God bless you. Thank you, and great segment, and I look forward to talking to you further. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
All right.